Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
There and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks. If you're a long-time listener who hasn't yet submitted your work, please do so. Remember, the work does not have to be fully complete or fully polished on this particular forum. If you're submitting to the agent of your dreams, of course the work has to be as good as it can possibly be. But when it comes to Books with Hooks, it might just be that you are noodling around with your query letter, or you're not 100% sure about your opening pages, in which case we can definitely add value. Just please keep in mind we are generally 2 months behind in terms of the queries that we're getting to because we get so many. So right now, this episode is airing on the 4th of April. We're only looking at the early February queries right now. So just keep that in mind. And the only way to find out if your submission has been chosen is to listen to the show. So make sure you listen to the show. Right, Carly, handing it across to you.
Hello, everyone. This is a reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer to our written notes for the fulsome picture. And a reminder, all of the ways that you can support us as a show, rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. Tell your writing friends about us. We love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, I'm going to hand it straight back to you. Will you kick us off with the first query letter?
The author wrote us a lovely little preamble. I will skip that for the purposes of the show and hop right to the letter. Dear Carly Waters, I'm seeking representation for my multiple POV commercial women's fiction novel, Jezebel. Complete at 85,000 words, it's single drunk female meets Ozark. Comparable to Tracy Lang's We Are the Brennans and Sierra Godfrey's A Very Typical Family. Recovering addict Serena Blair returns to the gossip-ridden Missouri Ozarks hometown that decried her, a grieving teenager, as the town Jezebel. Only her violent ex-boss could drive Serena back to beg her mother for the inheritance left by her grandmother in order to pay him off. Serena's mother, Jane Blair Reynolds, regrets allowing her grief to blind her to Serena's teenage struggles. Jane lost 10 years and won't abide her daughter running away again. She strikes a deal with Serena, spending the summer helping the new preacher, and she'll release the inheritance. The town's self-appointed moral guide, Florence Murphy, uses her influence over the townsfolk of comfort and Serena's history to force the younger woman to leave town. In her frustration, Florence lets slip a secret that upends Serena's entire identity, threatening her sobriety and risking the ruination of both of their lives. Serena finds an unlikely ally in a preacher with his own dark past. He encourages her to use the carpentry skills she acquired after rehab to build a future and win over the citizens of comfort. Meanwhile, Serena's ex-boss is closing in. Every day she stays brings danger to their doorsteps. She could slip off into the night once more, or she could stay and fight for what's hers. This novel is my love letter to the stealth feminists of the Ozarks who filled the hills and hollers of my childhood. I am a member of Chicago North Romance Writers and the Women's Fiction Writers Association. While not writing, I'm chasing my four boys, two human, two feline, in the Chicago suburbs. Interested in more? Please feel free to contact me. Thank you for your time. Beckon, James.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you. Seems like there was a heck of a lot going on in there. I don't know how we can offer to shorten that, but I'm going to make that your problem. Here we go.
All right. So I think at my word count, it only clocked in at 324. So it's not actually too long. And there's actually a lot of content in here. Okay. So let's get into my critique. Jezebel, this is not a unique title. I will say that off the bat. I think we can do a lot of work here to, you know, just make something more compelling, just more unique. So I think there's definitely a lot of work to do there. I think about your comps, Single Drunk Female, We Are the Brennans, A Very Typical Family. All of your comps have 3 to 4 word titles. And so you have a one word title. So you are the odd person out here in terms of your comps. So I would just be like realigning yourself with your comps and finding yourself a 3 to 4 word title, I think would be your goal here. Okay, next is we're kind of getting into the body paragraphs here. They're kind of short. And there's multiples of them. So we'll just start at the top here. I'm going to start with the recovering addict bit. So I feel like the kind of addict matters here. Like if it's gambling or alcohol or drugs or sex, like what is the addiction? I don't know. I feel like I need this to frame my understanding of like why she was decried the town Jezebel. I don't know. I think that could be important to me and my understanding here. I'm really interested in the grieving teenager bit, but I think one of my issues with the query letter is there's so much just like dropped kind of in our laps here, but it's kind of just being a bit vague, right? I'm like, okay, grieving, like grieving what exactly? Because we also, I think we get the mother's point of view. It says multiple POV, so I'm assuming we have Serena's, Jane's, and potentially the self-appointed moral guide, Florence. So I'm assuming we have 3 point of views, but it's not exactly clear to me. So you know, grief can be a lot of things, right? Like, and the mother, it says again, regrets allowing her grief to blind her, you know, from seeing her daughter's struggles. What are they grieving? You know, was it a spouse or a parent or a sibling, you know, a baby for the mother? Like, what is it that we're grieving? I don't understand that piece. And I would just love that kind of connective tissue to understand like how it brings everybody together. Okay. And now the whole why she needs to come back into town bit. I am very curious about this. I do love, you know, people coming back to their hometowns as an inciting incident. It's a common one, but I like it. It's kind of one of those tropes. I'm like, yeah, I understand it. It makes a lot of sense. It's kind of that human nature in us that like want to return to our roots. So I love it as a trope. It makes sense to me as a trope. All this said, why does she want the inheritance? So if she left in the first place, is she like, does she need the money? Is that why she's coming back? Is the inheritance actually a house? Is the inheritance jewelry? Is the inheritance money? You know, again, I think you're asking us to make a lot of assumptions here, similar to the whole addict thing. So why does she want the inheritance? So it seems like her ex-boss has something to do with it, but the line, only her violent ex-boss could drive Serena back to beg her mother for the inheritance left by her grandmother in order to pay him off. Like the hers and hims in that sentence utterly confuse me. I didn't really understand to the end that the boss was a he. And then I'm like, in the hers and all of that, I don't know. I ended up super, super confused here. And I'm interested in all the legal stuff. So why does the mother have control over the inheritance if the daughter is an adult? I have a lot of questions about that. There could be lots of like limitations in terms of, you know, trust fund and things like that. Again, I understand there's a lot of legalese here and we don't need to pack it all into the query letter, but I'm not clear on that. The other thing about this self-appointed moral guide of the town, like how is this woman so powerful that she can kind of upend this whole situation? That is just a little bit confusing to me, because with multi-POV, we need a reason for each point of view and they all have to kind of like come together at the end. So I don't know. I almost feel like, is Florence more of the kind of like Greek chorus of the situation, or why does she need her own point of view here? What are we going to learn through her point of view that we couldn't get through the others? And you haven't really convinced me, I guess, of like why this needs to be multi-POV in the query letter itself. And I also don't understand why Serena has to win over the citizens of Comfort. Why is that her job to like win them over? I don't really understand that piece there. Why does she have to win them over in order to get her inheritance? I just don't understand why she's jumping through all these hoops. And if she needed to run away, if there was a reason she had to escape, she's had a huge trauma in her life. And we're asking her to revisit all of her traumas for inheritance. Is it worth the money? And like, again, why does she need the money? So it all comes back clearly to this kind of ex-boss, this violent ex-boss situation. And we'll get to it more in the actual pages, because as a compliment, the pages are stronger than the query letter. So I will say that. I always think that's a compliment, because if you want anything to be stronger, you want your pages to be stronger. So at the end of the day, I definitely have a lot of questions, because we also have this novel is a love letter to the stealth feminists of the Ozarks. I love a love letter to all the stealth feminists, but I don't quite understand how this is a feminist novel if we're asking her to revisit all of her traumas. I guess I'm just missing it if there's like an uplifting piece at the end here. I haven't seen it in the query letter itself. And I think you're probably listening to this and thinking Carly is asking a lot of this query letter, but I don't know. I don't know what to say. I think it's just not doing the pages justice. So that's what I have to say.
Thank you, Carly. Cece, what have you got to add to that?
Yeah, just in terms of something new to say, I guess my overall feeling is that you have a lot of potential in your story, and I'm not sure how it all comes together. Like Carly, I also love the coming home trope. I think that needing money and striking a bargain with a parent to get said money, it always makes me think of Gilmore Girls, so that's also very compelling. Having a boss who is dangerous and who needs you to pay him is also like external pressure, so also very good. And being the town outsider, very good. So again, lots of potential. I'm struggling to see how it all comes together in a way that honors the web effect. So for example, if she's fleeing from her boss, isn't she worried that she's putting her mom in danger? I guess not, or else she wouldn't stay for the summer. So then something must happen to alert her boss that she's there. What is that something, and how is that plot point connected to the self-appointed moral guide of the town? Because in that paragraph, there's a mention that Florence Murphy uses her influence over the townsfolk of Comfort and Serena's history to force the younger woman to leave town. I think the younger woman is Serena. That was confusing to me, so I would just write Serena's name. So then, does she leave town? Because that paragraph made me think that she did. And when we have the line, like the major dramatic question line, that reads, "Every day she stays brings danger to their doorsteps. She could slip off into the night once more or stay and fight." And I guess I need to understand what danger that is, because if the solution is as simple as slip into the night and flee, it just didn't make sense to me. I don't think I see how it comes together, which is really hard to do in a story. So I very much empathize with the writer. I know we all do. But yeah, this needs work for sure.
Thank you, Cece. Yeah, hopefully just, you know, a case of really looking at your query and doubling down on the things that really matter, and, you know, just making it really, really clear so that when an agent reads it, they're not going, "I'm not sure what this means. I don't know who this person is that you're referring to, etc." And perhaps, you know, show it to a few of your beta readers as well, just to double check if any of those moments of confusion arise after you've revised it. All right, now I'm looking forward to hearing about the pages, especially since Carly has said that she feels that they're stronger than the query. So Carly, can you tell us what was in them and then your take on them?
Absolutely. Okay, so we're starting with chapter one. Our main character is on her way. I guess I shouldn't say main character because it's multi-POV, but this is the only character we know in these opening pages. She is on her way home. She's driving in the car. It seems to be dark, and she thinks somebody is tailing her. There's a car that's been following her for approximately 30 miles, which is a long way when you're in the middle of nowhere. And so she's kind of got this internal dialogue going on with herself about, you know, kind of the situation and what's happening, and should she turn off early to lose this tail? She does turn off early. The tail continues to tail her, and then she kind of quickly pulls off on a dirt road and kills the lights, and then the truck keeps going. So she's like, okay, it wasn't following me. She's still pretty shaken up. She ends up where she pulled off was a barn, and she knew the property owners. She grew up obviously in the area and knew them, so that was all kind of coming back to her. She gets back into the car and her cell phone doesn't work, and she's just kind of like cursing the situation. And so she ends up kind of making her way back into town. We get into chapter 2. She's trying to break into the church to talk to the preacher because she's like, this is the only place that I could potentially be welcome right now, and has a little conversation with God.
Breaking into a church. I'm already loving this scene. Okay. So what did you think of the pages, Carly?
All right. So my first line was, that's a good first line. And then I wrote, these opening pages are much better than your query letter. That's a compliment. So I'll read you guys the opening and why I thought that it was much better. And you'll probably agree with me. The secret to running away from home is never coming back. Her sponsor had uttered the words often. Except going home was the only way Serena Blair could save her own life. I've got a car for you, she said. It'll be perfect, she said. Serena's left foot tangled with the clutch of the cantankerous Subaru. A grinding vibration shimmied up her leg between gears. She wrapped her hand around the stick and prayed for the gear to make contact. The Ozarks hadn't gotten any flatter, nor had the highways gotten any straighter in the past decade. I think it's a really, really great opening. I think it's super, like, just subtle and just really interesting. For example, like, anybody that's driven a stick shift, which I unfortunately did have to learn how to drive stick shift, and I know, and that feeling of, like, maybe she hasn't done it in a while, and again, if the gears aren't connecting, you're like, I really want this car to work, and when you're driving manually, you're like, I'm the one in control of the situation. So I, you know, I just thought all of that was just really subtle, really great, and just, yeah, just super strong opening. So as I said, we get into the scenes where this car is tailing her, and I think what I'm struggling with in my main note through these pages, because the tension is so, so good, you know, because we're like, is this car like coming after her? What's the situation? But we have a couple things happening. We have this character having an internal monologue with themselves in italics. And then they also speak in dialogue tags to somebody else, to themselves. And so I'm just so confused, but like, why did we choose italics for internal monologue and dialogue to be spoken out loud? I'm not saying it's completely unrealistic to be like having internal thoughts and then you're also driving in the car and like speaking out loud. Again, this is happening in this situation, but why? I don't know, just for the sake of writing, I'm like, why do we need to do both? And how are you deciding what goes in and what goes in italics and what is speaking in dialogue tag? So I would just revisit that whole structure, because it might make sense later on, and maybe there is a reason that you're doing this, and it's, you know, some huge other thing that I don't know, a bombshell being dropped later. And that's, there's a whole reason why, but for the sake of these opening pages, I'm a little bit confused. I also feel like in some senses, we're actually repeating what we learned in the line above. So you might feel like you're adding, but I think you're actually just kind of taking away, because if you're just saying it twice in regular prose and then italics and then in dialogue, it's just, you know, a sense of repetition ultimately. So I would revisit a lot of that. One thing I wanted to say, so she pulls off, as I said, to try and lose this truck that she thinks is following her. And then once she gets onto the property, she's like, the barn triggered old memories. A friend from school had lived on this property. I almost wish that she would have noticed that before she turned off, to be like, I know exactly where to turn off. My friend lived here. We used to run through the gully and get dirty. You know what I mean? Like that sense of familiarity. Then she turns off. She's like, I know exactly where to go. You know, that like confidence in herself. I don't know. I would have liked that, as opposed to like, I just happened to turn off and this just happened to be the barn where my friend lived. I would just reverse that. But I think like you did a really great job of making us feel like stressed for her, because, you know, she's driving. We have the car tailing her. We have the, you know, cell phone not working. Yeah, I don't know. And we end with a cliffhanger on chapter 1, which is she could think of only one person who would be willing to take her in without question, period. Chapter 2. And then we, you know, get into the preacher scene. So yeah, I think tons and tons of potential here. I just have huge questions about that whole like italics dialogue thing.
Thank you, Carly. I have a suspicion that it's because we're starting with a chapter with the character by themselves, which we've always said is really difficult when a character's just by themselves. It's just their thoughts And perhaps the author is just trying to put in some dialogue there so it doesn't just feel like a wall of words. I could be wrong there. Just from my side, before I hand over to Cece, I just want to make the author aware. So your action beats are really, really good. So remember, action beats are interspersed with dialogue and they don't have he said, she said. So it says, how did I get myself into this mess? She let her head fall forward and leaned it against the open book of sheet music. And then later, after dialogue, she raised her eyes to the stained glass window behind the altar. Sorry, God. So those are great action beats. But just before that, it's dialogue. What can I get away without telling you? She whispered. And over there, the she is capitalized. So just be aware that when you do action beats, you can have a sentence capitalized. But when you're doing dialogue tags like she whispered, he said, you've got to have that lowercase she over there. So just double check those. Okay, Cece, handing over to you.
I really loved the ending of the first chapter too. I highlighted it and said, oh my gosh, this is a really good ending. I actually think that the tension here needs calibration because, as Carly said, you have us worrying for her from a plot perspective, right? Like there's a car that might be following her. She picks up her pepper spray. Like there's all these things happening that are very tense. But for my taste, she is explaining too much in her interiority and that's leaking the tension. So we get lines and lines of full-on explanation of what is going on in her life. And I don't need that so early on. I'd much rather have curiosity seeds with emotionality. An example is the fact that she calls her boss, Boss Dev. Like, I don't think she should call him Boss Dev, just Dev. And I'll wonder, who is Dev? And probably because of the way our society is, I'll be like, ex-boyfriend who's chasing her, you know? Like, I don't know. I'll assume something like that. And then one page later, I'm going to learn that Dev is her boss and I'm going to adjust that in my head. And those adjustments, they actually contribute a lot to tension because they make the reader feel like they're a part of the story and they're figuring things out and they're putting the pieces of the puzzle together, as opposed to just being told and explained things with all the context. So I thought there was way too much plot context and not enough interiority context. So for example, there's a part where she says, she's remembering her childhood friend, such a sweet, normal family. And I highlighted that and I asked, like, this is an opportunity for psychological acuity. Did she crave a normal family growing up? When did she realize hers wasn't normal? Did she ever stop having that craving? Did she ever let that dream die? And it's not necessarily because you're going to answer those questions in that spot, though you can if that fits your vision. It's more about when you zoom out, I don't want to zoom out to learn about plot points without emotionality. I want to zoom out to learn about her psyche and the way her brain works. I also do not buy the monologue at the end where she essentially tells us everything that's going on. Like, you'd be okay with me using my gift at the nightclub, but not my old boss. He's a mobster. Like, how did I get myself into this mess? So I don't think that she would be talking to herself. I know she's actually talking to the preacher in her head, but I just don't think that she would lay out her situation like that in dialogue. I'd much rather you cut back on the dialogue and have the interiority do the heavy lifting so that you can contextualize it to the reader. It would feel more natural, I think. So yeah, I definitely think the tension needs calibration as an overall note.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, we are now going to Cece's query. Will you read that for us?
Dear Cece, thank you for all the work you do for emerging writers and for providing constructive feedback on my memoir in progress through Manuscript Academy 3 years ago. Your advice was invaluable, and after rewriting and revising, I would like to submit my query and first 5 pages for review on the Shit No One Tells You About Writing podcast. After getting elected in 2016 and being thrust onto the scene as a feminist politician with a growing spotlight during a tumultuous year for women's rights, I began to fear that the secretive past I'd been harboring could get revealed, thus upending my reputation, career, and even my marriage. We Have So Much in Common is my 85,000-word dual timeline memoir of my struggle in advocating to end gender-based violence through policy and legislation, while secretly reliving past trauma of being trafficked and sexually exploited as a youth. For fans of The Many Lives of Mama Love by Laura Love Harden and What My Bones Know by Stephanie Fu, We Have So Much in Common is the only memoir of its kind to offer insights from an elected official with lived experience of surviving sexual trafficking while holding public office. Combining the intimacy of memoir with the rigor of investigative reporting, We Have So Much in Common reveals how my work as a politician grew into a reckoning with misogyny, violence, and the state of contemporary womanhood in the stoic halls of a traditional old boys club. As my work delves deeper into the realities of sexual trafficking, I get tangled up in the shame of my own past once again and realize that everything I'd worked hard to build is a crumbling facade. Only once I untangle from shame do I find the courage to share my secret with my husband, let go of worry of being exposed, and stop being triggered even as I'm being publicly and misogynistically attacked on social media. I begin using my platform to advance legislation and expand services for survivors like the girl I once was. Here, I find my greatest discovery, a spiritual exoneration for the crimes I'd once committed and a deeper intimacy with my spouse that is strong enough to withstand even the greatest of traumas. I am a recovering politician after holding office for 8 years and have returned to my roots as a writer. My weekly column appears in The Redacted on Tuesdays, where I offer political and social commentary and attract more than 100,000 readers each week. I received my MFA in creative writing from the University of British Columbia in 2015, and my nonfiction essay, Benevolence, was once a runner-up in the Edma Stabler Personal Essay Contest in TNQ magazine. I would be thrilled to send you my completed manuscript. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, can you give us an indication of how many words that was and what your take on that was?
So if we remove the first paragraph, which was clearly for the podcast, this is clocking in at 421 words. So, okay, I am going to critique a memoir, and this is always a challenge for me because it feels like I'm critiquing someone's life, someone's story, and I'm not. I'm critiquing the storytelling, which is a little bit better. I hope everyone will agree. I love that you are taking something so intense that happened to you and framing it in a dual timeline memoir. I think that that structure is going to serve you really well. But one of the timelines has you advocating to end gender-based violence that is very external, that paints a clear picture. And the other timeline has you reliving past trauma. And reliving past trauma is not a compelling way to frame that because it makes it sound like it's too interior. I don't think that's actually your structure. I think it's just a mistake, quote unquote, of framing it in the query letter. Maybe the past timeline is in the past where the trauma is actually happening. And if that's the case, remove the reliving mention because I don't want it to seem like it's there's an entire timeline where you're sitting and thinking and remembering because that will probably not be as compelling. And again, I sound like a big jerk being like, yes, your story, your life story has to be more compelling. But actually it does because that's what a memoir is supposed to do. In your plot paragraph, I think that you are giving us way too much big picture sentences and not enough specific plot sentences. So for example, you mentioned we have so much in common, your title reveals how my work as a politician grew into a reckoning with misogyny, violence, the state of contemporary womanhood. Like, that's great. That is a big picture sentence. And we already had a big picture sentence in the paragraph above. So you can remove that and regain those words, right? And then when we get into the next sentences in that paragraph, I was expecting plot. I was expecting specific plot that will show me how one thing led to the other thing, which led to this other thing, like the rising action that we need to lead to a climax. And again, the plot that we got was too big picture. It was things like, only once I untangle from the shame do I find the courage to share my secret with my husband, let go of the worry of being exposed. Those sentences, again, they're very important from a character arc perspective, but I wanted you to zoom in on the plot because I still don't know how I would film this if this were a trailer. And I had to be like, okay, we're going to pick these three scenes to show that the inciting incident, two rising actions, and climax. Like, I don't know how to do that because I didn't get enough. I got great, and I do mean great, bird's eye, big picture view of what's happening. But I didn't get dominoes tipping over plot. I also worry that in certain cases, you're framing this in a way that could leak the tension. So let go of the worry of being exposed. That's not good. That's too internal. That's you letting go, right? Like, I think it's great that you let go as a character arc thing, but that doesn't belong in the plot paragraph. I also think that the references to the crimes you've committed is kind of buried. Because when I got to that, it was at the end of the paragraph. I was like, wait, what? You also committed crimes? I wanted to know about this because that makes it juicier. Again, mean person critiquing someone's life, saying it should be juicy. But yeah, that's what I'm doing. So yeah, I don't know. A lot of the stakes right now are internal. Letting go of fear, forging a deeper bond with your partner. I want to know what are the external stakes connected to specific plot points. Because if this is all internal, it's going to be really, really hard to frame it in a compelling way for the reader. And now I will finish my very mean critique of someone's life. I always feel like a big jerk when I'm critiquing memoir.
Yeah, critiquing memoir is incredibly tough, but then it's a very, very tough category to sell in, which means it has to stand out even more, which is why we, you know, are here to try and help you do that. Okay, Carly?
All right, I echo obviously all of those sentiments and how we feel like big old meanies. And of course, we're just trying to set you up for success. And I think you know that obviously by sending your work into the show. So, okay, I will get to the critique. All right, so the second paragraph here, like it says getting elected and being thrust onto the scene. I would be interested in understanding the scope of the scene here, like elected to what position, or I don't know. I just feel like local politics can be super interesting. So I'm not saying it's like it has to be higher office or bust type of thing. It's more just, it just frames my understanding of what I'm about to read. So I do think that could be helpful there. I think you nailed the sentence, you know, the dual timeline memoir, my struggle. You nailed that. I think you did a really great job of kind of getting to that just heart of the story. The line that says the book is the only memoir of its kind to offer insights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I would never say that your book is the only blank of its kind, even if it's true. And I doubt, again, I can't say that it's true because you don't know what's coming on the market. You know, there's books, you know, coming out all the time and things in production that you don't know about. So even if you've done like the most comp research ever, you just can never really know again if it's the only of its kind. So I just wouldn't ever say that anything is ever the first of its kind. You're probably obviously trying to use that as a selling point. Of course, I totally understand why you're saying that. I would never say that or recommend it. Anybody says that. Okay, so now the line about my work as a politician grew into reckoning with misogyny, violence, and the state of contemporary womanhood and the stoic halls of traditional old boys clubs. So I think here we have to kind of get at what the outcome is and what did you discover on the other side? What will the reader learn? Like centering the reader a bit more here, because we know that we live in a patriarchy. You know, we know that we live in an old boys club. So that's not actually new information to us. And we can, again, assume what it's like to be in politics to a certain extent as a woman, right? So I would just try to center the reader a little bit more here. I think that could probably be helpful. I also think there's a bit of repetition I highlighted for you that you can kind of take that out to bring down the word count. But this is super intense, you know, like, you know, just from being publicly misogynistically attacked on social media, like my heart breaks for you. That's just so traumatizing. And I can't even imagine what that would have been like. So I'm just super in awe of you, you know, rising above and, you know, obviously putting pen to paper here to make a difference. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff here. I just think we need to center the reader a little bit more because ultimately it's for them, right? Not for you.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, what's happening in those opening pages?
All right. So we have the protagonist in line to donate blood. A woman recognizes her as her representative, and we zoom out to get an overview of how she came to be an elected official. And in this zooming out, we learn that she committed a crime in the past, a crime that is no longer in the criminal code, but that was back when she committed that crime. And to donate blood, she needs to answer questions, two of which require her to lie to be able to donate blood. And then we zoom out to learn that in a few years, the law would change so that she would no longer have to lie. She thinks back to when she was asked questions after being elected, specifically the question, have you ever done anything that could embarrass our newly elected government? And then she talks about her troubled childhood, her time in rehab. Yeah, that's what happens.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, what was your take on them?
I must first and foremost commend the writer here because these are incredibly polished pages. No clunky sentences. So many strong verbs. I kept highlighting the verbs and being like, this is a great verb for this situation. Like, and this doesn't just happen. This is someone who has talent and who clearly put in the work. There was always clarity of what was happening in scene. When I was in scene and she, not when I was in scene. See, I'm already thinking of myself as the character. When we were in scene and talking to the woman who recognized her and when we were thinking back to what happened in the past, I knew exactly when it started, when it ended. So much clarity, so much polish. And you've clearly put a lot of work into this, and I hope you're very proud of it because it's very, very good. What I think needs, and I think people are just going to guess what I'm going to say, is tension. And it's not because there isn't tension in your story. It's because you're leaking tension in the way that you're telling the story. We right now have two instances in which she says, a crime. I committed a crime. And then another instance where she says, I am lying. These are really tense, interesting things. And then right afterwards, in the following sentence, we learn that the crime will no longer be a crime in a little while, and the lie will no longer be applicable in a little while because the rules will change. And that leaks the tension. It absolves you as a human being, right? But we don't want absolution yet. Like, we don't want that. We'll save that till the end. I know the law will change. I mean, I didn't actually know. And most readers, I'm guessing, won't. But don't give away those goods. Let us be, like, in the moment, nervous about your crime, nervous about your lie. Don't tell me that it's going to be moot in a couple of years. Not yet. Save that. Save that for the character arc that you will need to develop. Maybe the middle of the story, maybe the end of the story. I don't know the exact spot, but yeah, I don't think we need that. We have, I highlighted the paragraph where you zoom out and you say, you know, pretty soon this isn't going to be a problem anymore because the policy will change. And I'm like, don't tell me that yet. You know, don't do that. I really, really wanted to understand why she had to give blood. Because if she has to lie in an official document, then there better be a good reason for her to be doing it. It can't just be out of the goodness of her heart. That's not believable. I thought maybe it was like a press conference opportunity. Like, everyone is donating blood and there's pressure from her political colleagues to donate blood. And so she couldn't back out. So I really needed that motivation to be clear. And given that both of our query letters today, both of our pages, I am saying tension needs to be calibrated, I thought that we could have a moment where I share my own embarrassment and sing a tension song. Because Carly once sang a timeline song.
Do it, Cece.
Carly sang a timeline song.
Do I need to sing the timestamp?
Yes, timestamp song. Timestamp song. So I have to be brave too and embarrass myself and do this. So, dear listeners, you can stop listening now if you don't want your ears to hurt a lot. But okay, let's do this. In honor of tension, which is so important, in honor of always upping the tension, I am going to sing a tension song. And this one is to the tune of Dreams by Fleetwood Mac. Okay, I can't look at you guys while I do this.
Okay. Should we turn our cameras off so you don't have to look at
us? I'm not looking at the screen. Okay, let's do this. Tension only happens with disruption. Conflict only follows when there's gumption. Say stakes, they won't come and they won't rise. Till you add desire, fear and surprise. Fear and surprise.
That was so much better than my timestamp jingle to the sound of children's music.
I think we're going to have to record that in studio. I did it.
If you want to learn more about tension, I'm teaching a tension course, my super popular writing tension course, next week. So I will not be singing the song again. So you don't have to worry about putting up with that. And yeah, and tension on everyone's mind now, hopefully. I'm sorry, Fleetwood Mac, for ruining your song.
Love it, Cece, love it. Okay, Carly, what was your thoughts?
All right, I don't even know how I can follow that. I mean, goodness, I need to upgrade my timestamp song quite a bit here. All right, here we go. Let's get into it. So in terms of the information you're giving us, so I didn't make any notes on the first page, but I put a lot of notes on the second page because you get into the, like, I was approached by a conservatist to run for office and I was thinking this and then, you know, this. And you, basically what you're doing is, I felt like what you were trying to do was like justify why we should read about you. When actually, again, you're centering yourself instead of the reader, because again, the book is about them, even though it's about you. Do you know what I'm trying to say? You're trying to give the reader an experience. And so by centering yourself instead of centering the reader, I think this is just where you're losing people in these opening pages. So what you need to do is train the reader to get this information as needed, not use it as a resume for like why you're qualified to write this book, which is, I think, what you were kind of inherently trying to do. So you'll see my notes in there all about that. What I thought you did really, really well was what Cece pointed out, which was the whole thing about making sure that they were, you know, with the intravenous drug use and trying to figure out like, had she, you know, done drugs and all the blood work type of stuff. I would keep all of that, but then cut the page before, because I think we'd be super curious about like, why is she worried about these questions about intravenous drug use? If we hadn't known the entire page before, we would have been much more curious about all of these big question marks. So I think that could be useful to you. And you'll obviously see my notes there. I absolutely love this line, which was, you've got a good one here, she said, tapping at the fullness of the vessel. I knew it was a good vein. I'd used it before. I mean, how great is that? Absolutely incredible. But at the end of that paragraph, she says, I saw it, another reminder of who I was, a faint scar, a track mark leading into that good vein. And like, wouldn't you be worried that the nurse could see track marks? Like, nurses are trained to notice these things. And so if you were like, you saw the faintness of it and you hadn't thought about it in years, wouldn't you be worried that the nurse would see it and be like, she's a fraud, she can't deliver blood, and like call you out? I think that would be pretty interesting. But yeah, other than that, as I said, I think that's my main note, is just like, I felt like you were trying to put a resume first, whereas I think you really just need to center the reader experience more.
Yeah. And sometimes the resume itself is the tension leak as well. So something to keep in mind there. Cece, thank you for your incredible song today. We appreciate it. Carly, we're expecting you to up your game for the next song. I will never be singing on the podcast, and I think we can all be very happy about that.
That's our goal now, to make you sing.
Never gonna happen. Right, okay. Let's go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words, so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages, from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday, the 11th of May, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which six amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists, while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Today's guest is the New York Times bestselling author of thrillers, including The Good Girl, Local Woman Missing, and Just the Nicest Couple. Her books have been translated into over 30 languages and have sold over 2 million copies worldwide. She lives just outside Chicago with her husband and her children. It's my pleasure to welcome Mary Kubica. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's thrilling to have you here because I've read your books for years. I have always been such a huge fan. And now I get to pick your brain for our listeners about writing in this genre. And we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of genre shortly. But before we do that, just I'm quickly going to let our listeners know what the book is about. So the book we're discussing is She's Not Sorry. Here is our flap copy. Meghan Michaels is trying to find balance between being a single mom to a teenage daughter and working as a full-time nurse. While Meghan is on duty at the hospital one day, a patient named Caitlin arrives in a coma with a traumatic brain injury after jumping from a bridge and plunging over 20 feet to the train tracks below. But when a witness comes forward with shocking details about the fall, it calls everything they know into question. Was Caitlin pushed? And if so, by whom and why? Meghan has also tried to stay emotionally detached from her patients, but this time she mistakenly lets herself get too close until she's deeply entangled in Caitlin's life. Only when it's too late does she realize that she and her daughter could be the next victims. Dun, dun, dun. So much to unpack there. First, Mary, I want to have a bit of a deep dive discussion about genre, because on our podcast, we have listeners who submit their query letters and opening pages to our literary agents who help them polish them up so that they can land agents. But so many of them seem to be confused about what genre they're writing in. And this particular genre can be really confusing. What's the difference between psychological thriller, psychological suspense? What's the difference between mystery, for example? This book as well has got strong women's fiction vibes. Now, we hate that bloody term on the podcast because it's like men don't talk about men's fiction. But there's so much here that has to do with being a woman in the world, women's concerns, being a single mom, women's safety, etc. So can you just unpack for us a bit about what you consider this book to be and if you think it straddles multiple genres?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like there is so much overlap in genre when you're talking about, you know, mystery and domestic suspense and psychological thrillers. And, you know, going back to query letters, when I first queried my first book, The Good Girl, I had no idea what the genre was. You know, it fit into many categories, I thought. So I tend to think of my own books as psychological suspense or domestic suspense. I, too, don't love the phrase women's fiction, but you're right that there is a lot in this book having to deal with women and things that women, especially when it comes to their safety, things that women are always having to think about, you know, and taking care of their kids and worrying about their kids' safety. There's a lot of that in this book. And so it speaks very much to that emotional experience of women. But I would say, you know, domestic suspense, psychological suspense, I think that so much of this book and all of my books has to do sort of with the why. You know, they're whodunits, but they're more like whydunits too, which is why I think that it goes into that psychological suspense category. I don't know. I feel like thrillers to me are very, there's more gore. And I think that mine are a little bit more, it's sort of just the psychology behind it. I don't have a lot of gore on the page per se. So I tend to classify my own books more as suspense versus thrillers, but I would definitely say domestic or psychological suspense.
So in terms of domestic, so is that got to do with family situations? Are we talking about whether it's mother-daughter, whether it's a husband and wife or two wives or whatever, is that how domestic gets classified?
That's what I would say, yes, for sure. In my mind, that's how it gets classified. Again, like in this book, Meghan is dealing with so many things. She's a divorced woman. She's raising her teenage daughter alone. And so there are so many things that she encounters as a mother, as a woman, as someone who is working. She's a nurse and she's trying to find that work-life balance, especially now that she is divorced and caring for her daughter alone. So all of that, you know, and I think that there are so many incredible books in this category, this genre. And what I think is so special about it is that we take, you know, everyday ordinary people just like any of us that are dealing with these everyday ordinary problems that, you know, we're dealing with, but then put them in these really extraordinary situations. And I think that domestic category, you know, it just makes these characters so much more relatable to us as readers. You know, it's not a police procedural. It's definitely looking at the individual person who is so similar to any of us.
Yeah, I love that. And it goes how far
will we go in similar circumstances? Because I think why people find this category so fascinating is because we all consider ourselves good people. We all consider ourselves moral, decent people. But in extenuating circumstances, if we're trying to protect ourselves, if we act in a moment of passion, you know, I think human beings are capable of all kinds of things. And I think we read these books kind of gnawing at our nails because we're like, what would I do in this situation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's what's so fascinating about it is, thankfully, the vast majority of us have never been put in these situations. And you just don't know what you would do, you know, when your back is to a wall or yourself or someone that you love is being threatened. You don't know what you would do in that situation until you're in it. And that's just one of the things that I love to explore with my characters, because, you know, I don't feel like I really write, you know, like really bad characters, but I feel like for the most part, they are just everyday people that are put in horrible situations and have to make difficult choices.
Yeah. Flawed characters or vulnerable characters are so much more interesting than people who've got their shit together, right? Because I don't want to read about people who've got their shit together. I don't even want to be friends with those people. So when it comes to my books, I really want to see flawed people, damaged people struggling and just doing the best they can.
Absolutely. Because they're authentic. You know, those are the people we can relate to.
Yeah. So for our listeners, before I chatted to Mary, I just wanted to get some definitions for you because these are questions that we have coming up often. So, you know, the literature says that thrillers are more about push and pull between the hero and villain in an established conflict situation, whereas suspense is about building tension and what may happen in the future. Whereas mysteries are about solving a crime that has happened in the past. And the literature also says thrillers are about suspense, dread, and fear of a future crime. So again, you know, it's not that that particularly clears things up. And, you know, Mary herself has said that she sees her work more as suspense, but Amazon is like, no, this is, it even says, it. This is what I'm loving about the metadata lately. It says, she's not sorry, a psychological suspense. I remember when my fantasy novel, The Witches of Moonshine Manor, came out 2 years ago and I went onto Amazon and it was classified as a witchy rom-com. Now, there was no rom, really, in this book. There was a lot of comedy, but there was no romance, per se. So that was pretty frustrating. Have you come across that kind of thing yourself, Mary, where you look at classification of your work or how the publisher or Amazon's trying to sell it and you're like,
I have seen that, you know, and like I said, I feel like my books are more suspense. They're sort of the slow burn. I love the atmosphere. And so there are times when it is, you know, classified more as a thriller and, you know, or things that are just being pulled out that are not necessarily there. And I think the reason that it bothers me is because the readers are expecting something different than what they necessarily get. And so they might be disappointed because they went in expecting something different than what was essentially promised to them. And so I think it's so important that books are accurately represented so that the reader, you know, knows what type of book they're getting.
Yeah, very much so. You know, I think for publishers, it's like, so long as the book sells, we don't care. But as authors and our branding, there's nothing more frustrating than seeing a review of your book where they're like, this is the worst rom-com I've ever read. And you're like, well, I agree because it's not a rom-com. So yeah, 100%. Right. So what I want to chat about in terms of writing a book like this is structure. Do you work with like a three-act structure? Do you use action beats that are kind of like save the cat action beats? How do you approach this? Because this kind of genre is so reliant on tension, which is so reliant on stakes. You need to keep upping the stakes. You need to keep upping the tension because you start with high tension and then it can't just drop because otherwise it feels anticlimactic. And especially in that second act, how do you keep just throwing things at your character, upping the stakes and the tension?
Yeah, so I don't work with an outline. I actually don't put a whole lot of thought into my books before I start. I'm just, you know, I'm a pantser for sure. I dive in and see where it goes. So I don't put a whole lot of forethought into, you know, the structure and things like that. But I try to always start with a bang, whether that's, you know, adding a prologue or something like that, that's going to immediately hook the reader in. And then I do slow down a little bit to build up that pace again. And so, you know, it's one of those things that as I'm writing, I'm always thinking about it, you know, but it happens more on the revision process, that I make sure that the pacing and the tension and all of that is there. And it's sort of just for me, like a gut feeling as I'm reading through the manuscript again and again and again, are there areas where I'm getting bored, you know, are there certain scenes that I just don't want to have to read again? And it's moments like that that I know, okay, I've got to go back. I've got to add tension. I've got to add some more cliffhangers in here, something to really lure the reader in and keep them invested in the story throughout. And, you know, all of my books, I feel like there has to be that tension building phase and the building of the atmosphere. And all of that is so, so important to me, the character building and all of that. It's a point too, though, where readers, you know, they maybe want a little bit more action. So it's important to make sure that there's that balance there between creating these really atmospheric scenes and building that tension and creating these characters that readers can really, really relate to while keeping the pacing strong. So again, as I'm writing, I'm thinking about it. I'm trying to do my best, you know, to put all of that in, but it's more, I would say, on the revision process that I can really, really make sure that it's exactly how I want it to be.
Firstly, pantsers of the world unite. I hate plotting. And I agree with you. The magic really happens in the rewrites and in the polishing up of things. You know, the great part is sometimes you can move things around. Maybe something happened earlier in a draft and you decide, okay, that can come a little bit later. Or, you know what, I'm holding off on this reveal too much. I'm going to have to move it earlier. Same goes for red herrings that need to be planted, because in this kind of book, you want the reader actively engaged. The reader needs to be coming up with theories the whole time. They need to be, ooh, this guy looks suspicious. There's something off about him. I'm going to keep my eye on him. Ooh, this is very interesting that this has been mentioned. Because especially when you are hiding something in plain sight, you want to be like a magician who's like, look over here, so that you're not looking at the thing that you want revealed too early on. Now, early in the book, you have it that in Chicago, where she lives and works, there is a predator, you know, on the loose, someone who is hurting women, who's attacking women, etc. And this really creates this atmosphere for the single mom and her daughter of being threatened, of constantly being on the lookout. Something simple like her walking home is no longer something simple. It is like, oh my God, I need to, do I have my keys in my hand? Is everything ready for me to go inside? So that's such a great way of taking something that is everyday and using that to create tension. Is that something that was in there very early on? Is it something that was added as you went along? How much layering do you do as you write?
That was one of the things that I added early on. I think it was the first time that Megan is walking home from work alone. And, you know, it's probably chapter 2 or 3, something like that. And she's walking home from work alone. And this is something that's just so relatable to women. You know, we are taught, we know that, you know, number one, try not to ever walk alone at night. But if you are, then you need to be prepared and you need to be alert and you need to have your keys in your hands and all of these things. And Megan has, this is about a mile commute home from work. And she has this teenage daughter who is often home alone on the nights that Megan has to work. So she's concerned for her own safety. She's concerned for her daughter's safety. And again, these are things that, you know, women are always just very aware of. And so it was so relatable. I mean, I think that, you know, women everywhere will understand, you know, the position that Megan is in and how she fears for her own safety and her daughter. And so then we have this man out there that is attacking women at random. And, you know, so I thought of it by chance when I was writing this scene of Megan walking home, and I didn't realize, you know, exactly how big of a thing it was going to be in this novel, but it's just kept building, you know, every time that I went to write Megan walking home, and just, you know, you start to hear more and more about these attacks happening on women in the city. And so it's just such a dominant part of Megan's life. She's dealing with, you know, things at work and issues at home, but that's there in the back of her mind all the time, that there is a man out here attacking women.
And it's also a really great shortcut to get the reader on board with your character. Because if you can give a personal universal element, that immediately helps the reader have a shortcut to the character and go, I can imagine how they feel right now. So every woman who's reading your novels has had one of those moments where she has been like, oh, this road is too deserted. It's too dark. I need to check to make sure that I'm safe. So the minute we see the main character going through that, we're on board with her immediately. We can relate. We're rooting for her. We worry for her. So, you know, that personal universal element is also really important in storytelling. Another question that I have for you is what came up earlier in terms of you calling it domestic suspense. Do you know, Mary, your demographic of readers? Are they mostly women? Do you find that a lot of men are reading domestic suspense?
Men do read my books, for sure. I don't know exactly what the numbers are. I would say it's more heavily women, but I know that I have many men that attend my book signings. I have men who have, you know, tagged me in reviews or sent a note on Instagram or Facebook, you know, to let me know that they love the book. So I definitely have male readers out there, and it's always interesting to get their perspective. But I would say that the majority of my readers are women.
Yeah. And is that something you keep in mind when you're writing? Is it at the back of your mind going, this is who my audience is, this is who I'm writing for? Or is it a case of that is your publicity and marketing department's problems? You sit down to write a good story well told.
I sit down to write a good story. That's my goal. You know, I want to please my readers and all of that. But I write the book that I want to read. You know, I write the book that is inside of me, the story that I want to tell. And, you know, whoever reads it, I feel like. That's something that I can't be too focused on because I think it'll take away from my writing. That said, this book, She's Not Sorry, has one female narrator. But the majority of my books have multiple narrators, and I've written many male narrators, you know, so I feel like they could definitely be suited for both men and women. But it's one of those things that I, as a writer, don't think about necessarily. I, again, just write the book that I want to write. And what happens from there is up to my reader, up to sales and marketing.
What I love is my favorite acts are Act One. As I'm doing things like, oh, she's walking home. What's happening? Ooh, someone might be following her. There's some creep in the neighborhood. Interesting. How can I incorporate this into the story? And then I like Act Three because even though I don't plot, there's like a kind of end that I'm working towards. There's a premise that I'm working towards. But then I struggle with Act Two because those are all the, you know, Act Two is 50% of your novel. That's where so many writers lose readers because, you know, they're either holding on to information too long and the reader feels manipulated or the reader gets bored, etc. Your Act Twos are so damn strong. So I'm guessing Act Two is not a problem for you, or else if it is, you've figured out how to whip it into shape.
Well, thank you for that. I will say it is hard. You know, anytime that anybody asks what the hardest part of writing is for me, I always say it's that middle part because, to your point, the beginning is new and exciting and, you know, the book could go anywhere. And then the end is really where all those pieces come together. And it's so satisfying. And I just love that, you know, sense of resolution. And it's a great feeling. But the middle, you have to keep the tension high. And again, like you said, it's like 50% of the book. And so that's always in the back of my mind. You know, things can't be getting boring here. And I can't be just leading the reader, you know, down the wrong paths again and again, because they're going to feel manipulated and get upset with that. So like one thing that I do try and do is build more than one mystery into my books. So instead of just, you know, everything relying on this one big twist at the end and we're trying to get there, is I try and have sort of many layers of mysteries, smaller things that need to be solved. And that sort of serves two purposes for me. Number one, that, you know, there's other things that are going on in the middle of the book besides just trying to get from, you know, point A to point B. There are other things to solve. But number two, because this type of book, you know, the success of it so often hinges on that big twist and whether you're going to surprise the reader. This way, there's so many other things to solve and so many other mysteries for the reader to try and, you know, figure out themselves, that should they predict like the big twist at the end, hopefully there are still a lot of other surprises for them along the way.
Yeah. And you really need to balance the clues you give the reader and what you're withholding. Because by the time the reveal or the twist happens, they should have enough information that if they were really paying close attention, they could have figured it out. Because there's nothing more frustrating than this left field reveal. And the reader's like, well, how the hell was I supposed to figure that out? I didn't know about this character, or I didn't have this information. Now, what you do really well, and I don't want to ruin this book for anybody, is that you hide things in plain sight. But you also do it in such a way that if we're not paying attention, we aren't going to clock onto it. But when we come back to it, we're like, oh, interesting. That's where I should have picked up on it. So let's talk about writing an authentic twist that is genuine, that the reader could have perhaps figured out if they paid enough attention, and how to balance planting curiosity seeds and withholding information so that it can be a surprise later on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you said is just the most important thing, is that the reader does not want to feel manipulated at the end. A twist has to be earned. And I love that phrase, you know, hidden in plain sight, because that's what it is. The reader needs to be able to go back, you know, if they wanted to, and read it and see all those clues that they missed the first time around. And, you know, it's a balance for sure. And it's, I doubt myself sometimes, you know, are some of these clues too heavy-handed? Are they not enough? So it's definitely a struggle, you know, sometimes to go back and forth and figure out like where that balance is, that the reader's going to have that wonderful sense of satisfaction at the end and not feel manipulated, but also that the clues aren't so heavy that they figure out what that twist is going to be long before it comes. And because I'm not a plotter, so often I don't know what my twist is going to be. So then it's, you know, it's a process of once I figure it out, sometimes going back and, you know, laying that little breadcrumb trail for the reader. With She's Not Sorry, it was a bit different experience because I did know the twist in advance. And so I was starting from a different point, you know, I sort of created the story to go with this twist that I had. And so it was a different, but really exciting and neat experience to build up to that twist. And so right away, you know, I had to ask myself, well, how am I going to, you know, of course, some of this stuff is so hard to talk about without spoilers, but how am I going to sort of lay that trail for the readers so that they have that great sense of satisfaction, that aha moment when they get to the end? And, you know, I just kind of try to think through ways that I can do it that are not going to give the reader too much information. And it's subtle. It's so subtle, you know, and I before the book was, you know, completely done, after my editor and I had gone through and edited it, and it was almost done, I had a number of friends read it, you know, just to get their feedback and find out, you know, did they see things coming and all of that. And thankfully, no, you know, everybody was really surprised with this one. But it's just, it's so beneficial, you know, to get some early reads on it too, if you're somebody that is writing this kind of book, just to see, you know, have you struck the right balance there? And, you know, that's just so helpful. My editor provides great information. You know, she really helps me see if I've given too much or not given enough. But those early reads also from just any trusted reader are incredibly helpful.
Yeah, because somebody can only read the surprise once. So, you know, for our listeners, if you're writing this kind of book and you're wanting to get beta readers or people to read it, try and get it as polished as it can be before you get them to read it for the first time. Because once they know the surprise, they know the surprise. And if you haven't quite calibrated it, sending it back to them for calibration is going to be difficult, because then now they know in advance. So you may then have to get all new readers. Great advice that I've mentioned before, and we got from Lord Geoffrey Archer when we interviewed him for the podcast, is he said, when you give away information that is that information in plain sight that makes something clear, he said straight afterwards, like in the very next sentence, give to the reader something so shocking that they completely forget about the really important information that they got before. And I thought that was really great advice. But even, Mary, while I was reading the flap copy earlier, I spotted a clue. There's even a clue in the flap copy, which I didn't notice originally, which shows that you clearly were very intentional with your flap copy. It wasn't a case of, you know, marketing just saying, okay, this is the flap copy. You were like, again, I don't want to give it away, but I'm sure you were involved in that, right?
I was. And I mean, that copy was the hardest copy that I think we've ever written. You know, my editor wrote it, you know, a draft first and shared it with me. And I took a look and I think made some changes. And there were many, many conversations about how to do this, you know, how to make this engaging and make a reader want to read this book without giving too much away. And we had to be so intentional with it. And what you said before about, you know, when you lay those clues, when you hide something in plain sight and then, you know, shock the reader with something else right after. I love that. And I try to do that too. And I know that there are so many times that a reader has said to me that they thought they were onto something, but then, you know, I talked them out of it. And I love that, because that too is what I intentionally try to do, because you've got to lay those clues there, you know, but then you also have to convince them that it's not that.
Yeah, for this kind of book, your reader has got to be theorizing. They've got to be like, this person, no, wait, oh, no, wait, nah, now it's actually this person. You need to give them enough clues so that they constantly are coming up with new theories. And sometimes they're going to be right, and then they're super gratified. They're like, yeah, yeah, I knew that was happening. And then boom, straight afterwards, you hit them with something else that they're like, holy heck, man, I did not see that coming. So it needs to be a roller coaster for the reader when they're reading this kind of novel. And that's 100% what you provide. Have you got any advice for our listeners who are writing in this genre?
Yeah, I mean, I think number one, read widely in the genre for one is just, it's so helpful, you know, just to see what other authors are doing for you as a reader to see, you know, what really moves you as a reader, what do you love? Because I think that I'm always paying attention to that. You know, when I read a book that I love or I'm shocked by a twist, you know, I try and kind of pick apart, I'm always learning, try and pick apart what was it that the author did that made me so excited, that totally shocked me, you know, what types of twists are just blowing my mind the most. And so I'm always absorbing that and seeing, you know, what I can do to my own books from what I'm sort of learning in the books that I'm reading. So read widely in the genre. There are so many incredible authors writing in this genre, just doing amazing things and coming up with, you know, things that haven't been done before. And I love it. So that would be number one. I think number two, just when it comes to like inspiration, watch true crime stories, you know, listen to true crime podcasts, just be really absorbed in the world of, you know, mystery and see what excites you as a reader. What are the things that you want to explore and, you know, see how you can kind of pull that into your own writing. I think that that's always so important. You know, every author is different. So I'm totally a pantser. You know, I love to dive in and just let my characters lead me. I like to go in, you know, every single day. It's so exciting to me to not have any idea what's going to happen in the lives of my characters. And to just, you know, some days I'll dream up like some line of dialogue and it'll totally make me see a character in a different light. And I love that. It's just, it's so motivating to me. But that's me. You know, there are many authors out there that need to completely plot the whole thing for it to work. And so you have to find what works best for you. And then, you know, I just think that creating really flawed but authentic characters is so important. You want your reader to be invested in this character. You want them to care about them. They don't have to like them necessarily or agree with the choices that they're making, but you want them to be pulled in on that emotional level because then they're going to want to see it through. They're going to want to see what happens to the character in the story. And then, you know, just create that tension. And like we said, with the twist, make sure that it feels earned.
Amazing, Mary. Thank you so, so much. For our listeners, we're linking to She's Not Sorry on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you purchase it there, you support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. Mary, we hope to have you back for the next one.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.